afternoon, Commissioners, Mr. Director. I'm Joe Shoren. I am Chief of the Fish, Wildlife Division of the Attorney General's Office, and it is my pleasure to visit with you today about public records management issues and opportunities. So there's sort of three aspects of public records management that I'd like to talk with you about today, and I consider them to be the three legs of the public records stool. One is the Public Records Act, which concerns responding to requests for public inspection and disclosure of public records. The second is records retention, which concerns schedules and obligations to retain public records that are property of the state. And the third concerns preservation of evidence that may be needed in litigation. And these are all somewhat related concepts, but they do have distinct obligations and processes associated with them. So what I put up here is a statement of intent in Chapter 4256, which is the Public Records Act. The act was initially adopted by an initiative of the people, and this statement of intent sets forth the expectation of the people, of the citizens, that they remain informed of the government's decision-making so that they can retain control over the instruments that they have created. It's a fairly strong worded statement, and that sentiment permeates the Public Records Act. So the Public Records Act includes a broad mandate in favor of disclosure of public records, and I'll get to sort of the specifics of how that mandate is implemented. It does have a number of exemptions, and those exemptions, as construed by the courts, are construed fairly narrowly. The courts have consistently held that the primary purpose of Washington's Public Records Act is to promote broad disclosure of public records. So here's the basic requirements of the Public Records Act. First, agencies must make available for inspection and copying all public records unless they are specifically exempt from disclosure. And there's a specific timeline associated with responding to those requests. I want to first at the outset make a distinction between requests for public records and general requests for information. General requests for information like, tell me what you plan on doing about this issue. Those are not subject to the Public Records Act. The Public Records Act are requests for actual records, and you don't need to create records to respond to them. But if there are records that the agency has, and we'll get into a little bit of detail about some nuance on that, but if there are records that the agency has, that's what we're talking about here. The agency has an obligation within 5 days of receiving a public records request to either provide the records that were requested, to deny the request, or to acknowledge receipt of the request, and then inform the requester about, you know, what reasonable time estimate they think that it may take to respond to those records. So you can imagine that oftentimes requests are fairly broad, and it would be nice if they came like one request at a time, but often they come in a letter that has a lot of different requests sort of buried in the same letter, so it can be fairly complicated to respond to them. Luckily, the department has a fairly well-oiled machine in the name of Teresa Gibbs, who's behind me here, for processing those requests, and I think has it pretty well down to a science, but like anything, it is highly dependent on individual custodians of records to play their part in the process of producing those records. There is a limited ability in the Public Records Act for the agency to recover its costs for producing records, and the department provides a small charge, 15 cents per page for paper records, which is the statutory sort of set standard. And then also there is an ability to charge for scanning or the cost of a disk, But the Public Records Act does not allow the real cost of producing public records, which is in the time of agency staff, to actually find the records. And the more records they have, the more time it takes to find the records. But the Act does not recover staff time for searching for records. So it is not uncommon, and I think it's probably most common, that if a request for public records comes in, that it's going to take more than 5 days to respond to it. Unless somebody's looking for a simple, you know, one document or a small, defined scope of content. And it is allowable to take more time to either clarify the intent of the request, to gather the information. Sometimes the agency is aware that there are parties who dispute the legality of disclosing the records, and there is a provision in the statute that allows the agency to notify those interested parties and give them an opportunity to go into court to try to get a restraining order to stop the department from releasing those records, and we have done that on a number of occasions. And then finally, it takes time to determine whether any of the records that have been requested are exempt from disclosure. So if the department is going to deny a request and not produce a record that has been requested, it can't simply just not provide the record. It has to specifically inform the requester in writing, and it has to explain exactly why it is, what the legal basis for withholding that record is. And typically that involves creating what we call an exemption log, which lists the records that have been requested and all the records in within that request that are being withheld and what the statutory basis is for withholding those records. Also, oftentimes, an exemption may apply only to certain portion of information in a record. For example, if there's an email string and there may be a portion of that email string that contains attorney-client privilege communication, but then there's a whole bunch of other conversation in that email string about other things that would not be subject to the attorney-client privilege, the Public Records Act requires that only that portion of the record that is exempt from disclosure be withheld. And that portion would be redacted out, but then the remainder of the record has to be produced. So doing those redactions takes time, it takes effort, but it's very important work. Generally speaking, the agencies cannot distinguish among requesters. In other words, you basically have to treat sort of everybody the same. And you're also not allowed to condition the release of the record or require that the requester tell you what they want to do with the record. There's some limited exceptions there. And one common exception that's in the statute is that records cannot be requested for commercial purposes or certain records. And so there's a requirement that folks who are requesting records can basically indicate that they're not going to use the record for those purposes. But beyond that, generally speaking, it's not appropriate to require the requester to tell you what they're going to do with the record as a condition of producing it. So the Act applies to requests for public records. So I want to look a little bit at what that means. What is a public record? And I've excerpted the statute up here in 4217.02.041. It's any writing containing information relating to the conduct of government or performance of governmental functions that is prepared, owned, used, or retained by any agency, regardless of its form or characteristics. So that's a pretty broad definition of public record. It speaks to a writing. It also defines what a writing is. It includes handwriting, typewriting, printing, photographing. Basically, any recorded form of information is a writing under the Act. So as a result of that broad definition of public record, there are a lot of things that are, in fact, public records that are subject to production. Some obvious forms of electronic records include, you know, email, data, electronic calendars that relate to government function. There is a case right now concerning in the Washington Supreme Court concerning text messages. Text messages are considered public records. And of course, paper records, and that includes not just the final finished product, but drafts. Your handwritten notes when you are sitting as commission members are public records. Now, we'll have a different conversation about how long those have to be retained, and that's sort of the second leg of the stool is the retention. But once they are created by you in your role as commissioners, they are public records. Audio recordings and photographs and the things of those nature are also public records, again, if they are prepared, owned, used, or retained in reference to governmental conduct. So once an agency receives a public disclosure request, the agency has to search for responsive records. And the cases say that that search has to be reasonably calculated to locate all responsive records. And what that means is that the agency has to search in all places where those records are reasonably likely to be located. And if you have, and agency employees have, agency records, in other words, records that relate to WDFW business and commission business on home computers, then you have to search the home computer for that record. Other devices as well. If there are agency records on those devices and those types of records are within the request, then those devices may need to be searched as well. So if you receive a public records request directly, you should immediately forward that, I would say, probably to Tammy, and then she can get it to Teresa. Because, as I mentioned earlier, there's a limited period of time to respond to the public records request, so it's important to act quickly. And while most frequent flyers and regular requesters know to send their request directly to Teresa, and there, you know, there is information on the department's website that identifies where public records requests should be sent, the law doesn't really require that the request be in any particular form, and so it could be buried in a letter, and oftentimes they are buried in a letter that contains other information or requests for information. And so you should be on the lookout. And if you receive something you think is a request for a record, you should immediately let Tammy or Teresa know.
Those individually?
Tammy?
You would be coming to you directly at your personal emails.
Right, that's what I mean. Has that ever happened?
Not since I've been here. I mean, typically they come into the
room. Yeah, okay.
Great.
Can I make one?
Make one, sure.
You know, an important thing is a lot of them come to Tammy's office, come to the commission mailbox, or some of the more the regular flyers, you know, come to the public records office. But if you see one, if you end up having correspondence in your commissioner role with a citizen, and it starts off just you and that citizen, and the citizen, you know, you're reading through an email and it says, and I want this, you know, document, and I want this document. And you don't, I mean, if you get a copy that has gone to Tammy, then I think you can be certain Tammy and Teresa are in cahoots. But if you're the only one, you know, or you see it's just you and another commissioner or just you and someone, then red flags really have to come up with you there, and you have to get it into the process, because the five-day trigger, I mean, it starts from the time it goes to the first state person. So those are the one to really look for.
Yeah, and I don't want to belabor it, because apparently it doesn't happen that often. But, you know, you say in our commission role, I mean, the emails that all of us get, you know, come from a wide variety of roles. So sometimes it may not be as easy to discern it's in a commission role. You know, so I, again, it hasn't happened. I'm not going to worry about it, but I just throw that out.
Well, you know, a little bit later, I'll offer up some ways that you can maybe distinguish between those roles that might help. But that, you know, that's a challenge.
Yeah, because people do contact me just as a subject matter expert or something in certain areas. You know, and it could be right. In another role. But it could, because my roles have environment or natural resources, you know, strung like a spider web. So, God, it's so hard to be serious with it.
So,
I try.
If
here, so I'm sitting here.
Oftentimes there are requests that come into the agency that, you know, do not implicate records that the commission is involved in because it's not a commission issue. So, as a matter of course, I don't believe that you're getting every. I'm confident you're not getting every public records request sent to you, but the agency does. Teresa, working with individuals in each of the programs, does send those requests out to those portions of the agency that they believe are reasonably likely to have responsive records. And sometimes there are some that are sent to the commissioners. So if the department provides you with those records or provides you with a public records request and they'll come by email and ask you, do you have anything? It's very important for you to respond thoroughly and quickly because if we were challenged, which we have been, on the responsiveness of the agency to a public records request, we will have to demonstrate that we did a reasonable search and we looked in all the places where we might reasonably expect to find records. So that includes basically making sure if you are among the folks who have been identified as likely custodians of responsive records, we need to be able to document that you have looked for those records. And if you haven't found any, you know, that you've looked reasonably, and if you haven't found any, that we've at least asked and confirmed that. So I want to emphasize the importance of responding to those requests promptly, because not doing so will create a liability risk for the agency. Also, don't assume someone else will produce a record. I mean, we've seen situations where, you know, one staff thinks, oh, I thought someone else would do that. And I think when in doubt, for example, if you're not absolutely sure that Tammy has the record, I mean, for example, there are certain records, I think as Bill was suggesting earlier, there are certain records that go to the entire commission, like the minutes, for example. You know, she is the custodian of the minutes. But there may be other records where it's not so clear whether Tammy is producing them. And it's only a phone call away if there's any question in your mind, hey, I've got this record, I think it's responsive, should I, you know, should I bring it up? Yep, Commissioner Caney?
I would say 95% of what comes to me as a commissioner comes to me through Tammy. But it might be a letter from so-and-so or a letter from so-and-so. You know, please review this. It comes to all the commission. And if there's anything to do with that particular subject in a freedom of information or request, I would normally write back, you know, other than what you've provided, I don't have any further records. So I am assuming she's going to put that forward if it was a freedom of information request, rather than me go through all the files and send any file. You know what I'm saying? It's 99% has already come to us through the commission process. Is that a legitimate assumption?
I think as long as you are clear with Tammy in your communication, that you follow up and you're clear in your communication, I think it's fine. I think that where we would get into trouble is if we're not sure what record you're talking about.
So just so you all know, typically, always, when we have a public records request, I say response needed, response required. And it usually clearly says PDR gives a last name, which is exactly what I'm getting from staff in the request to us. If you don't respond, I don't know if you have anything. It's critical that you respond, even if it's nothing. Just say nothing. But it also kind of gives us the closure on that PDR, so it's not, well, no, I don't know because somebody didn't respond. So it's usually highlighted pretty clearly in the subject line that there's an expectation for you to do something with it.
And yet if, like I say, if most of what comes to us is through you anyway, I'm not going to send back 100 emails.
9 copies of each of those from
yeah,
one of you.
Because it came to me. I mean, that's where I think it...
Yeah, I understand that. I think that makes sense. I want to give one caveat, which is if all of you have the same record and then 3 of you take notes on that record, 3 of you have created a new record. So if you have that record and you've got handwritten notes on them, that's a different record. So now sometimes requesters really don't want that stuff, and more often than not, they're not that precise in what they say. But sometimes they just want the letter from such and such to such and such, or the nature of the request is such that it's clear they're not looking for notes. But many requesters are not that precise. So with that caveat in mind, I think what you're describing is fine. Does that make sense to everybody? Yes.
No.
Public record.
Right. So now I should retain these in a certain place.
Well, we'll talk about, in a moment, we'll talk about retention. But that's a different question. The Public Records Act deals with if you have it and somebody requests it, what are your obligations? Different set of laws concerning if you have it, do you have to keep it, and for how long? If you have it, and there is a public records request, and it's a distinct public record, do not destroy it. Once there's a pending records request, then you need to hold on to the record. Now, again, if it's a duplicate copy and we've confirmed that it's a duplicate copy, that's not a problem. But if it's an original record or, it's got your notes on it or whatever, once there's a public records request, then you need to hold on to it.
So in the 95% plus that Jay was alluding to, that of correspondence that comes to us, comes through Tammy, the retention of each one of those is not necessary. Right.
Right. If Tammy, if you send something to them, you are retaining it. Is that correct?
Right. We would just be inundated. I mean, all of us would. Okay.
Right.
So it's all right if we get a letter or a correspondence to all of us from Tammy, we read that, we can delete that.
Yes, Tammy will retain that.
But what's key to remember, too, is if you then take that, Brad, and forward it to Larry with a comment or suggested
right.
something
right.
else that I don't know anything about.
Yeah.
That
I wouldn't send it to Larry.
Then that becomes different.
Oh, much different.
All right. So as I mentioned earlier, there are some exemptions to the Public Records Act, and I want to talk broadly about them. I'm not actually going to walk you through each of them, although I'll give you a teaser and I'll flash the screens. But as I mentioned, the courts construe these exemptions narrowly, and the burden is on the agency basically to establish that the shoe fits in order to claim or rely on an exemption. Most of the exemptions are permissive and not mandatory. Sometimes people get that language backwards. So if a record is exempt from disclosure, generally speaking, except for certain types of records, that means that the agency has authority to withhold the record, but it doesn't mean that it's required to. And sometimes it's not 100% clear whether it's exempt or not, or we think it is, but we're not sure. And that sort of plays into, I think, the balance of decision-making about whether or not to actually withhold it or not. If there is a question about whether an exemption applies, then we'll get a call from typically from Teresa or sometimes the program, and we'll have a conversation about it. But I want to emphasize, and I emphasize this to agency staff too, it's not your job to withhold records that you think are exempt. I mean, I like to think of Teresa as a big funnel, and she collects all of the records. And some of those records may be exempt, and it's fine if you think an exemption applies to you know, pass that along. But ultimately, you must provide the record, because even if there is an exemption and we're going to rely on it, it has to be referenced in an exemption log. If there are portions of the record that are not exempt, then the exempt portion has to be redacted and the rest of the record has to be produced. So there's sort of a whole process associated. So it's not a self-help kind of situation. I guess that's my point.
Teresa's where the exemptions are sort of decided. And so that keeps it really consistent throughout the office, throughout the agency.
Yep. So for purposes of there's two categories of exemptions. One is that many agencies have statutory exemptions that apply to their agencies. This is the statutory exemption that applies to yours. It's actually, the statute's actually, a page and a half long. It deals with certain catch data, sensitive wildlife data, certain personally identified information from licensees, and certain information that is deemed confidential under the Federal Magnuson-Stevens Act.
An example of sensitive wildlife data.
Oh, locational data for endangered species.
Okay. Wolf dens.
Wolf, okay.
Yeah.
You're right.
But then there are also other general exemptions that sort of come up commonly. Certain personnel information, certain investigative records, real estate appraisals, certain preliminary decision documents. We could spend, an hour just on the exemptions, and I don't think you're best served to do that. So we're not going to do that. So your good intentions don't really matter in terms of whether you're complying with the Public Records Act. I mean, it's a strict liability statute, so either you complied with it or you didn't. Your good intentions may play into how big the penalty is if you didn't comply with it, but in terms of whether you comply with it or not, it's irrelevant. The Act does come with penalties for violation, and you may look at $100 a day and think, well, ooh, that's not too bad, but those penalties add up. That's $100 per violation per day, and the courts have a fair degree of discretion in determining how to apply those. And there have been a number of very significant judgments against state agencies and against local government agencies in excess of $1 million, many in the hundreds of thousands, many, 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 many in the tens of thousands. So these penalties can add up, and it does create a risk to the agency. And I think I think you have been briefed before about a couple of significant public records cases that we have settled for the department based on potential liability risk.
And the requester gets the penalty?
Oh, yeah, the requester's and the requester's lawyer. The requester's lawyer typically gets a fair amount of it, but actually, technically, the penalty goes to the requester. That's correct.
And the violation might be for each record. So it's not $100 per incident.
Right. And actually, the statute provides for attorney's fees, too. So now, so we have sort of all that on one side of the scale. And on the other side of the scale, the Public Records Act says that an agency has immunity from liability for good faith efforts that it takes to produce or release records in response to a public records request. So if you're acting in good faith and someone requests a record and you release it, there is virtually no risk of liability to the agency. If we're not sure if the exemption applies, because frankly, some of these exemptions are not, you know, it's not 100% crystal clear. That's why you have lawyers. You know, you've got a significant risk of liability. And so on balance, there's always going to be, a benefit to disclosing these records. I mean, the Act is designed, basically, to make it more worth an agency's while to disclose than it is to withhold. That doesn't mean that we don't withhold for legitimate reasons when an exemption squarely applies and the agency wants to. But you know, on balance, if it's uncertain, you know, tie goes to releasing the record. So the number of public records requests to the Department of Fish and Wildlife is on the rise. I think, Teresa, you provided these numbers. So you can see, you know, last year.
Without being specific, which I guess you can't be on this, if you were to take out five requester names, would that 311 be 290 or would it be 100?
I'm going to defer to Teresa on that.
Smile tells the story.
We do have quite a few frequent flyers that makes multiple requests, so it would decrease that number.
And I'll say that, you know, these numbers are on the rise for all agencies. And it's not just that the number of requests are on the rise, but, and we'll get to this when we get to records retention, but the burden of sifting through the enormous accumulation of records that agencies have collected, which has exponentially increased in the electronic era, has just, you know, blossomed, I guess I would say, over time. So it's, you know, it becomes an additional burden. So I'm going to close out the public records portion, which was the sort of the biggest lift here. But here's a summary. Remember that, you know, any writing relating to the commission's work is a public record that is subject to disclosure if it's requested. And generally speaking, disclosure is the rule. Withholding is the exception. It can be painful to be in violation of the Public Records Act. Please, if you get a request from Tammy asking if you have any responsive records, please respond promptly. And if you think you may have responsive records, you need to do a diligent search of those records and provide those responsive records. And I would say, to the extent that you are all have your own devices that you're using, and we'll talk about devices a little bit later, but if currently you're using your own devices and you need help searching, you know, understanding how to do a search, I would say let Tammy know, and we can work with Tammy and ISD to get you some training. ISD, you guys call your, what do you call your information services? ISD. Yeah, to get you that training so that you know what you're doing.
We did on the number four, the promptly respond. I mean, we can hammer this, but yes or no, you know, a no answer. If it goes to litigation, you know, and they're sort of your requests or inquiries to you become important in the litigation, and there isn't a response from you as to whether or not you did a search, whether or not you did have records, you know, if there isn't a response, then that $100 or whatever it is per day, but every day from the day that the department closed it to whenever we get a response from you, you know, is potentially a violation. So a response, positive or negative,
is better than no response.
Okay.
Is our RCW on this the norm in the other 49 states, or are we in the middle, or more restrictive or less restrictive?
You know, my understanding is that Washington is one of the, you know, the most what's disclosure friendly,
open
government. There's a real strong mandate here, stronger than in most other states.
And I think it's in two places. It's the breadth of the openness and the penalty forcing mechanism to make it work. You know, and one is as important as the other, and the penalty thing is really becoming a bigger and bigger driver in local and state government process. Good news, though.
Okay, so we've talked about one leg of the stool, which is public records and producing public records. Let's talk a little bit about retaining public records. And this is subject to a different statute, which is RCW 40.14. And it's actually, you know, compared to the Public Records Act, it's a fairly small chapter in RCW. And the basic requirements here are that public records are property of the state. So when you write a letter or send an email relating to commission business, that email is state property. Why we would want it, I don't know, but it's state property. Your notes relating to commission action, they're considered public records. And the law provides schedules for how long the whole spectrum of records that are created in the conduct of state business, how long those records have to be retained. And generally speaking, the records that have been produced have to be retained for the full length of that retention period. And then at the end of that retention period, they may be disposed of in the ordinary course of the agency, individual agency's sort of record, public records retention processes. However, there are a couple of exceptions, which I've mentioned one, and I'll mention the other, which is that in the event that there is a pending public records request, then if that record relates to that pending public records request, then it is not appropriate for it to be disposed of, basically, at the end of the retention period. Or if that record relates to litigation or potential litigation, which is the third leg of the stool I'll talk about in a minute, that record has to be retained in that circumstance as well. The retention schedules, there are basically two schedules. There's a statewide schedule and an agency-specific schedule. And I'll tell you that the statewide schedule is sort of mind-boggling in terms of the number of categories of records, and it's quite complex. But the agency does have some agency-specific schedules, and you also have staff that is dedicated to working with the programs and with staff to ensure that you are doing what you should be doing to retain public records pursuant to the established schedules. And Linda Burris here, wave your hand. Yep. Is your records retention officer, is it?
Records officer.
She does quite a bit of work to provide training and to make sure folks understand what their obligations are. So, in anticipation of, if you get to the end of the retention schedule, in other words, you have a certain record and it doesn't have to be retained, you can dispose of it, right? But if you keep it and then there's a public records request or litigation and that record relates to it, well, it's fair game, basically. So it's in your interest to reduce the number of records that you have to sort of search through to look for responsive records by following the established records retention schedules and to dispose of records that have reached the end of their retention period unless you really need them. It doesn't pay to be a hoarder, I guess is what I'm saying in this business, because you'll have to go through the same records and search for responsive records again and again, basically, if you're keeping records that you really don't need. So do we have
a handout?
We have a handout?
Yeah.
Okay. So do you want to talk them through this?
Sure. So I left, or Tammy left on your table a one-page deal, and I have to tell you, I am a reformed record hoarder. At the beginning of my legal career here, I kept everything because I thought anything that anyone has ever thought or done might come in useful, might become useful to me later, because so many of your problems come up and then they don't come up for another 10 years. You know, they don't come up every day. They come up, you know, we're doing this and then we don't do it again. So I kept and kept and kept and kept, and now have come to the conclusion, particularly after the recent case we had with Mr. Vandervoort, that it's better to reinvent stuff for the most part, and get rid of as much record appropriately, following the record retention schedule. But it's just better to get rid of things because the penalties for failure to disclose are so enormous, and the cost of searching. You know, if you routinely have to go through stuff. And there's a ton of stuff. I don't know that we see every AG public records request, but the AG's office gets a bunch of them too, and they send them out. The public records officer, in trying to figure out who reasonably should search, sends them out throughout the AG's office and says, "We got this request. You might have records. Search for them." You know, and so every agency is now becoming a searcher of public records in a much bigger way than they ever have been in the past. So what this document is, this is a document created by the department, and it, as they're staffing up this whole process. And what this document does is it identifies by categories a number of different documents. And this identifies probably all the categories of documents that the entire department has. And what we did was we highlighted in yellow a couple of things that I think you might have. And then the ones in red are things that the commission might have, but we think Tammy is probably the most likely source of them, so you don't have to worry as much about them. But I thought I'd go through this. And I also printed and brought, so the Secretary of State is the keeper of the record retention schedule. That's the entity that decides for any particular record, they make the schedule of how long it needs to be kept. And so for some records, they're kept forever. You either keep them in your agency or you keep them for a while and you give them to the Secretary of State and they keep them forever. At the other end of the spectrum is stuff that is just of really transitory value, and you keep it as long as you need it for the most part, and then you can get rid of it. You can save any record you want for as long as you want, but if you save it, it becomes part of the database of stuff that potentially has to be searched. So I'll meet you for lunch tomorrow at 2, really transitory. You can get rid of it as soon as you can. The information we do in treaty tribal litigation is probably in the category of going to be kept forever. And there are 100 pages of categories with different timelines. There's probably about 10 different time categories of stuff.
So it shouldn't take us more than an hour and a half
right.
to get through those, I think.
Yeah. But what I did is flag the ones that I think you most likely come across, and then these time frames in the column over to the side, these are time frames that the department is going to be able to use with a computer program that they're moving to, I think. But they give you a sense of sort of the relative time that you need to keep a record according to the Secretary of state schedules. And the agency does have its own specific schedule, and I looked at that, but it doesn't cover the A to Z records. It just covers certain specific types of records to the department. As I looked at that, it really didn't apply to you, as far as I could think. So, so let's look at a couple things. So copies is in this group that is what's called transitory records. And they're to be kept for as long as they're useful, and as soon as they're not useful, you can get rid of it. So copies, preliminary drafts, telephone messages, these things that don't have any lasting value, they're really low-value things. And what the Secretary of State is doing in through this whole process is trying to sift through all the stuff that the state creates and preserve those things, first identify them, and then get those things preserved that are should be part of our history, you know? And so telephone messages about lunch, no. Indian treaty litigation, much more interesting in a long-term historical thing. So so copies of stuff. You know, your commission notebooks is a copy of the database of stuff that is this commission meeting notebook. So even though your book is a public record, to each of you, it's a copy. Now, if you make notes in it, that becomes a different record. And so we would need to think, okay, what are notes? Well, your notes are probably a transitory thing, and so they're probably under the same they're useful as long as they are to you. If you want to keep it, you keep it. But as soon as you don't need it, get rid of it. Preliminary draft, so if you started a letter and it took you three different drafts to get it done, those initial drafts are transitory. You can get rid of them as soon as you're done with them. Telephone messages, same thing with my note, hey, let's go to lunch. General correspondence, so in this thing you'll see there's correspondence highlighted in the six-month category, and there's paren 30 days. The 30 days is what the Secretary of State obligation is. The six-month thing, I think, is how the computer system is going to sort of catch up with all that. So the 30 days is what the Secretary of State requires for this thing called general correspondence. If you look at general correspondence, and then there's this thing called correspondence per in program level, and then if you look down about right in the middle, there's both yellow and red. That's got to be really interesting. Correspondence slash executive slash official. So if the director writes a letter to someone and says, you know, I wanted you to know the following important information about my view or what the department's doing, because he's the director, the Secretary of State recognizes the stuff he does as, quote, executive. And so his stuff is more important in the Secretary of State's preservation mind than if someone else lower in the agency or if I wrote something. And so if I wrote something, it's much more like this program level of correspondence. And so in correspondence, they've created three categories. And the lines aren't exact in the Secretary of State's deal. They can be frustrating. But director-level correspondence is long-term, longer-term stuff. If it's correspondence, this one in the six-month column, 30 days, if it's something really routine, really regular, really low-value stuff, then it has a 30-day time limit. So if you were to write one of these correspondence things in the general category, you would need to keep that for 30 days, and then on the 31st day, if you didn't have any reason to keep it, you could get rid of it, according to the Secretary of State. If it was
For example, you know, general emails, right? I mean, I often treat many emails as general correspondence. Probably 30-day timeline for most emails.
If you wrote, if a staff person wrote a detailed letter about the deer populations in Area 463 and how they've gone up over the last 10 years in response to some inquiry, well, that person isn't an executive, but it's more than routine general, and so that fits in the, that's probably the program level deal, which has a two-year when the department's computer system catches up, it will save that for 2 years, and then it'll automatically dump it. And you could do the same thing if you wrote one of those letters. An interesting question is, you know, you're the commission. Are you the executive of the agency? Well, in some senses, the commission as a body is an executive of this agency. But I think you as individual letter writers, because only maybe the chair, unless there was delegated authority, but if any one of you other than the chair just wrote some response, you know, I think this, my own personal commission view is the following, I think that would be a program level deal because you can't bind the commission. If you had delegated authority, the commission asked me to write this letter on their behalf to tell you, you know, the deer populations are doing just fine over here, then that is probably an executive level deal. So, requests for information, the same thing. If you get a letter from a constituent that says, hey, we want all this information on grazing and blah, 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 that is probably one that the agency would need to keep for a year. And then at the end of that year, if there wasn't a reason on the agency's mind to keep it, it could get rid of. And so so that's sort of how this works. The ones I highlighted are the things that I thought you most likely got. I don't know how often you individually write a letter. If you had a calendar that you kept only for your commission business, then that might be something we would think about. There are categories for calendars. I don't know whether you do that or not. All the other things that I saw on here were mainly things that Tammy gets. And so one other thing is, let's say a citizen writes the chair a letter. And it's one of these requests for information with a one-year deal. So the chair, if he opened up, and it went to his home address, if the chair opened it, and it was clearly in his chair role, and opened it, then because he received this original letter, he's got this one-year obligation for this letter. If he mails or sends the original or gives the original to Tammy, even if you keep a copy, Tammy now has the one-year obligation on the original. And if any of you have a copy of that letter or later get a copy, you have a copy. And so just because you open the letter doesn't mean you're stuck with the obligation. Right. But the agency has to just keep track of there is the obligation. So
most of what you're getting, I expect, from the department is copies. I mean, if the director sends a letter or staff send a letter, there are probably a lot of letters that you get copied on. You don't have an obligation to keep those unless you do something to them to make them a unique document of your own. But if you're being copied on correspondence that the department sends, the department will satisfy the retention obligation. You just treat it as a copy.
Yeah.
So.
There's your answer.
And if you have questions, don't hesitate to call Tammy or me, and we'll talk with Linda or the group and figure it out.
All right, that was really fun.
I have a question. How long should we hold on to this stuff?
I do have a question. If I've learned to not take many notes, but sometimes I'm thinking about other stuff. So, like, you know, I have a note to myself, clean the fish pond when I get home. Is it because I'm here as a commissioner, whatever I write, or is it just what pertains to commission business?
I would say that if you're writing yourself a note about a fish pond,
I'm just using that as an example.
Yeah, I would say it's what relates to agency business.
Okay.
You know, I mean, if you're taking notes on your, you know, state-provided computer, for example, which you don't have, but if you had one, you know, that might make it a little more complicated.
Right.
But yeah, it's really just the information that relates to the conduct of government. That's what makes it a public record. So,
a little different twist on that is if you write something though in your commissioner context, but it's intended to be funny or personal, or you know, so and so is, you know, has funny hair today or whatever, You know, and it may be transitory, but if it's not transitory or you get a litigation or public records request, even though it's uncomfortable, you know, if you can't get rid of it, you can't get rid of it. And so that it continually reminds us to watch what we write.
Not that you can answer this, but there is no disincentive for certain individuals to be those frequent flyers that you alluded to.
That's correct. There is no disincentive.
I mean, because the burden of everything falls on us, not...
Yep.
I think there is some... Because some people are being so sort of extreme about it, there is starting to be maybe a little bit of a balanced discussion, but it is a long way before I think people are willing to look at some balance from the agency local government point of view. But open government is the way of the way for now.
I do have this is a real question. I see you have a note about emails and you mentioned Outlook profile. I keep my work emails you know, with Office 365 and Outlook, and there's a function that and I put all my commission emails in a separate folder. And there is a function that allows Microsoft to delete emails within a prescribed period of time, you know, in a particular folder. I mean, are you recommending that maybe that we, for people like me that do it that way, would be to have it set up where we delete emails after 30 days?
Well, I think it would. I think it depends on the content of the email, really.
Most would be general correspondence.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think having an auto delete for general correspondence, as long as, and we'll get this for the next leg, as long as you know how to turn that thing off, if we issue a litigation hold and it relates to that, or if there's a pending public records request. But after this next segment, we'll talk briefly about some tools that might be available for commissioners to help that. Sounds like you may be doing it pretty effectively with your own device. There's some other options as well. Okay, I want to get to the last leg of the stool here, but I want to introduce Bill Falling, who's in the room. Bill? Bill is the Department of Fish and Wildlife's Information Governance Manager. And... you want to step up and say hello, or just say
hi, everybody.
And I'll just say that that WDFW, like many agencies over the last several years, has realized that the number of issues and complexity of managing their records, particularly in this electronic age, really for all three legs of the stool that we're talking about today. Is significant enough that they have hired people like Bill to be information governance managers to help them really sort of think about how the agencies can, you know, on a sort of enterprise-wide basis, improve how they manage the records to best serve, I'm making your pitch here, to best serve the staff and the agency mission and minimize the liability of the agency. So,
yeah, I'll just give you guys an example of quick stories. I think people like to hear stories. I was speaking with a colleague today, and I asked him, have any agencies ever gotten in trouble for commission members not producing records? And I believe it was the Board of Accountancy had failed to produce some records, and it turned into a lawsuit of $571,000. So it got me thinking about how important this is at all levels of agency commission production. So it's a lot of work, but if we take the appropriate steps to get where we need to be, then we've taken those reasonable steps to produce records that we might have, and it'll definitely minimize any damage we have. So pleasure to meet you.
Thanks, Bill. Okay, I have one more leg before you are released from the stool here. This has to do with evidence preservation electronic discovery and litigation hold notices. So there are a number of federal and state court rules and case law that require that and dictate how agencies have to locate, preserve, and produce records that may be evidence in litigation. I refer to these as potential evidence in litigation. And one form of those records is ESI, or electronically stored information. These principles apply to all records. They're not new. They apply to paper records. But because the electronic world has, A, so dramatically increased the number of records, and, B, so that the nature of those records are so much more fleeting than a paper record, and they're so easy to lose accidentally or delete, there is a great deal more process now that has been developed in the courts for ensuring that those records are managed appropriately. So ESI, or electronically stored information, it's basically electronic data, and there's a bazillion different kinds of it, you know, everything from email to text messages to data files and whatnot. And it is located in all kinds of devices. And the number of devices that we use, you know, increases over time. Heck, our cars have electronically stored information in them that, you know, communicates over the internet data about those vehicles. I mean, it's there's sort of no end of where that information can be located. So what is important to understand is that if litigation has been filed or is, quote, reasonably anticipated, that creates a duty to preserve potential evidence that may be needed in the litigation. And generally, when we become aware of certain types of litigation, particularly litigation where it is likely that there will need to be discovery, where records will be sought, we will issue what we call a litigation hold. It's a notice, and you commissioners have received them on occasion in the past. What you receive is a small fraction of the number of litigation hold notices that go out to the agency. But we'll issue a litigation hold. That hold will be distributed by the agency to those folks who may have potential evidence. There's a
Deb here? No.
There's a person named Debbie Rick, who is the litigation hold coordinator for the agency, and her job basically is to push that notice out to the right people and then to track their responsiveness in terms of you know, having them respond and identify if they have records that may be needed in the litigation. If so, what kind of records are they? If a litigation hold notice is issued, then the schedule, the retention schedule, is suspended, basically. So the whatever thing you might do to get rid of a record at the end of a retention period, that is suspended, and the record has to be retained. And when we send out a litigation hold, we will tell you what records and types of information we think is likely to be needed in the litigation. And by the same token, if you think litigation is likely to be filed, please let the director know, or let me know, or let, you know, agency staff know, so that we have the information needed to basically notify the right people of the duty to retain their records. The Department of Fish and Wildlife has a procedure that it's adopted that directs staff, and it applies to you as well, in terms of how to respond to a litigation hold. And I'm just going to summarize it here for you to give you what you need to know. But the bottom line is it puts the obligation on the assistant director for the program that is most related to the litigation, puts the onus on that person to work with the litigation hold coordinator to figure out who may have relevant records, and to whom should a litigation hold go. The hold coordinator distributes the hold. They work with the hold coordinator and with our office to develop search terms, because oftentimes for these electronic records, you know, you're having to do searches to find them in sort of the big bin of records that we all have. The agency has a process for preserving emails. Most of the emails that are over 30 days or so are stored in a statewide vault operated by CTS, Consolidated Technology Services, which is a separate agency. And those emails in the vault can be preserved centrally in one location. And then they track compliance with the hold. Sometimes the hold includes what's called a verification checklist, where it says, please identify if you have, you know, any of these kinds of records. And if you receive one of those, it's important to fill it out. Yeah, so if you receive a hold notice, just, you know, follow the directions. It will come by email. It'll say in the header, you know, litigation hold or new lawsuit. It'll be pretty obvious that it's important. Make sure that you review the records that you have. Identify any records that you think are responsive. It's important, unless we tell you it's not, that you maintain your records in their native format. So if you have a record that's responsive to the litigation, and let's say it's an email, don't print the email and then delete the original record. It's important because in some cases we may be required to produce the record in its native format. So unless somebody says, you know, unless you get direction from the AGO, basically, from the AGO, I would say that preserve those records in their native format. If you have questions about what you're supposed to do, which would not be surprising, please, you can contact Tammy, and you can also contact the, you know, DFW help desk, and they're trained to help people sort of in what they have to do to preserve their records. So here's sort of the downside is, just like in the Public Records Act, like there's pain, you know, if you don't comply, there's pain if you don't preserve your records for litigation. And here, too, there is a whole host of cases out there and more every day involving public and private entities that are severely penalized for not preserving evidence. There was a Court of Appeals decision just in April here in Washington that involved some pretty significant failure to preserve evidence and failure to produce a smoking gun record in a lawsuit involving, it was liability associated with a Cessna plane crash. And the court basically struck all the defenses of the defendant and deemed all of the allegations in the complaint deemed, and then submitted the case to the jury. The jury awarded $17 million. So there are pretty significant – the court has wide latitude in terms of the penalties that it can impose. It can direct a verdict. It can apply monetary sanctions. It can hold the agency in contempt. So it's, you know, it's pretty significant, and there is a whole sort of machine now in the legal industry associated with – associated with helping parties manage records appropriately and punishing them when they don't. So here's sort of a best practices for records management, and I'm getting pretty close to winding up here. Don't unnecessarily create records. You know, manage your records for easy search and retrieval. So as Commissioner Kehoe said, he's got some discrete locations that he's keeping his commission business in. Use folders for particular types of information. Get rid of it if you don't need to retain it. And preserve records that may relate to anticipated litigation or pending public records request. And promptly respond to the email from Tammy or from Deb Rick or from me or with a litigation hold or on a public records issue, and do what you can to segregate your personal email from, or your personal records from, the agency records. There are, I just want to mention, I got two slides, I'm going to hit these pretty quickly, but there are some tools that are available to the commission if you would like them. And these slides were developed by Rod White, who is the chief information officer for the department. And he has made arrangements so that commissioners, if you want, you can receive a state enterprise username and password that would allow you to use the Washington State email system instead of your personal email system. And you can get what's called OWA, or Outlook Web Access, so that you can basically use your personal device to send, receive email through the state system. And that's a great way to segregate your records from your personal records from agency records. It also provides, yes. That is definitely preferable to having it intermingled. Absolutely. Yes. And this basically would do the same thing. The one advantage of this method is that for vaulted emails, emails that are older than 30 or 45 days, I forget what to, you know, 30 days, they go into the vault, then those emails can actually be searched centrally and can be preserved centrally, whereas your personal setup, we couldn't do that. But they also can provide you the ability to get into other agency networked resources on the agency intranet. They can provide you with a laptop so that you're not mingling devices for your commission business. And at some point, they could provide you with, I guess, access to their SharePoint shared information services. So that's something that, you know, you ought to consider. And I think if you're interested in exploring what that might look like, I encourage you to let Tammy know, and she can work with you and Rod to make it happen. But it will reduce the chances that your personal business will get intermingled with your commission business, which, you know, in the wrong case could make it uncomfortable for you. So that's what I have.
Thank you
for your patience.
Joe, is this just new, the last slide, is this something new, this now that we can go through this state email program? Is that something that just came out, or has that been out for a long time?
It's been, technologically, it's been around. We've had, you know, some ongoing conversations. I don't think that usernames have been, accounts have been created for the commissioners yet, but they are now. And so I don't know if you've been specifically offered this in the past, but they're offering it now.
No, we haven't. Thank you.
Yeah. All right.
Any other questions? You guys are deleted.
Mikey, it's Mikey's turn.
So, when we got to go into executives.
Yeah, let's take a 10-minute.
Okay.
5 or 10 minutes.